Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now covering in this audio Lamentations chapter 3, the first 32 verses of the chapter, which I will entitle Great is Your Faithfulness, Part A. Part B will be the last half of the chapter in the next audio, Great is Your Faithfulness, Part B. Now, this is a Job-like chapter. Jeremiah is talking about how horrible everything is, but he still has hope in the midst of his horror. This is an acrostic poem. They are 22 Hebrew letters. There are three verses per each Hebrew letter for a total of 66 verses. We begin now in verses 1 through 4 of Lamentations 3. I am the man, this is Jeremiah speaking, I am the man who has seen affliction because of the rod of his wrath. He has driven me and made me walk in darkness and not in light. Surely against me he has turned his hand repeatedly all the day. He has caused my flesh and my skin to waste away. He has broken my bones. That sounds exactly like Job. And I'll tell you, I don't know how these prophets had the cojones to talk to God like that, but they did. Now, you know, the standard exhortation is that you are free to complain to God all you want. Well, I would say that's true up to a point. You're free to say, I don't understand, I don't like this, please help me. But don't ever question his justice. And as we see, as we go through this first half of Lamentations 3, Job will never question God's justice. He's just saying that God has caused him to walk in a hard, hard place. Now, I said in verse 1 that Jeremiah was the man who had seen affliction. Some people say this is a personification of Israel. I am Israel who has seen affliction. I am the man Israel who has seen affliction. I don't think so. Some people even say this is a type of the Passion of Christ because Jesus saw affliction. Adam Clark quite appropriately says this is, quote unquote, without any foundation. Now, in verse 1, Jeremiah says, I am the man who has seen affliction. Other prophets had prophesied of Jerusalem's destruction, like Isaiah. But these prophets had not actually seen it. And Jeremiah didn't see it from afar. He was right there when the city fell. He had been in the cistern in the courtyard of the guard, which is located in the palace. He had been taken out of that cistern and put in the jail there in the courtyard. We read in Jeremiah 38, verses 12 through 13, Abed-Melech the Cushite cried out to Jeremiah, place these old rags and clothes between your armpits and the ropes. Jeremiah did so, and they pulled him up with the ropes and lifted him out of the cistern. But he continued to stay in the guard's courtyard, and he was there when the walls got broken down. Now, eventually he was sprung and taken up to Riblah and then released. But he saw it all, and he was very miserable because of what he saw. Verse 3, surely against me he has turned his hand repeatedly all the day. Actually, God had turned his hand against Judah. But Jeremiah so closely identifies himself with the sins of Israel that it's just like God has turned his hand against Jeremiah. So even though Jeremiah knew that Israel had sinned and that her punishment was precisely condign, perfectly deserved, even so he was still sad. It's just like in America when the axe falls on America's heads for our grossness, our moral filth, it's going to be a sad thing. It already is a sad thing. We go down to Lamentations 3, verses 5 through 8. He, that's Yahweh, has besieged and encompassed me with bitterness and hardship. In dark places he has made me dwell, like those who have long been dead. He has walled me in so that I cannot go out. He has made my chain heavy. Even when I cry out and call for help, he shuts out my prayer. Jeremiah says in verse 5, he has been besieged and encompassed by Yahweh. Perhaps this is a reference to the siege of Jerusalem. Or perhaps it's just metaphorical. At any rate, Jeremiah says in verse 5, he's bitter, or he's suffering bitter things, I should say. Maybe he doesn't say he's bitter, but he's encompassed with bitterness, with bitter things, and with hardship. In dark places he has made me dwell, walled me in verse 7. Well, if you're in prison, it's dark, and you're walled in. He might again be referring to the siege of Jerusalem, or he could be using in general a metaphor for his trouble, a general metaphor. But he's walled in like people who've been dead for a long time. That sounds like he's walled in a mausoleum, in a coffin somewhere. At any rate, he's trapped. And God, in verse 7, has made Jeremiah's chain heavy, his leg chain that he cries around, his griefs, his bitterness that he drags around with him as he shuffles through his miserable life. Jeremiah says in verse 8, he cries out and calls for help. God's not listening. How many times have we been through that one? Because God always likes to wait before he answers. He always delivers, but he'll wait to see how well you're going to handle the trial. We go to Lamentations 3, verses 9 through 12. Jeremiah continues, "He, that's Yahweh, has blocked my ways with hewn stone. He has made my paths crooked. He is to me like a bear lying in wait, like a lion in secret places. He has turned aside my ways and torn me to pieces. He has made me desolate. He bent his bow and set me as a target for the arrow." So referring to the wall that had walled him in verse 7, verse 9, Jeremiah says that God has blocked his ways with hewn stone, that stone that's been cut so that it fits together. A lot of places didn't even use cement when they had hewn stone because the stones fit together so well you didn't need any mortar. In other words, the stone was perfectly fashioned so that nobody could break through. "He has made my paths crooked." Of course, a crooked path is harder to walk than a straight path. Verse 10, bears and lions are waiting to jump on him. Verse 11, "God has turned aside my ways." In other words, Jeremiah's intended path has been turned aside. Jeremiah's life surely didn't go the way he had intended. He had a very rough life, if you ask me. Well, if one turns aside his ways, he gets off the beaten path, the next thing you know, there's a bear and a lion waiting to eat you up. You are a prey for wild beasts. God has made Jeremiah desolate, like a wilderness. Verse 12, "He bent his bow and set me as a target for the arrow." Ooh, Job said that. Job 7:20, "Have I sinned? What have I done to you, O watcher of men? Why have you set me as your target?" It's pretty bad when you think God's shooting arrows at you. Lamentations 3, verses 13 through 16. Jeremiah continues, "He made the arrows of his quiver to enter into my inward parts." In other words, he shot me successfully, and I've got arrows sticking in me. God, where are you? Verse 14, "I have become a laughingstock to all my people, their mocking song all the day. He has filled me with bitterness. He has made me drunk with wormwood. He has broken my teeth with gravel. He has made me cower in the dust." Jeremiah was a laughingstock to everyone. One of my commentators said that was especially true of his townsmen, the men of Anatoth. I looked up the Hebrew for this word, and I'm trying to learn some Hebrew now so I can get through the Old Testament. And I learned that if the tau or the tav does not have a little dot in it, a little digesh, then you pronounce it TH. I just learned that from a Jewish rabbi, no less. So then I look at the Hebrew, and yes, the tau does not have a dagesh, doesn't have a dot in it, so it should be pronounced th, anathoth. So then I look at Strong's Concordance, and they have it all pronounced for me, anatot. Excuse me, anatot. The O is long. And so this is what I say about pronunciation. I don't really care. I listened to this rabbi complain about how the Ashkenazi Jews pronounced Hebrew. Then he complained about how the Yemeni Jews did it and how everybody else in the whole world, the Israeli Jews, they don't pronounce it right. But by golly, he did. He was using some Jewish rabbi who wrote about 1,000 years ago telling us how to pronounce ancient Hebrew. So I'm just going to do the best I can. But that's a long rabbit trail. Why is Jeremiah a laughingstock? Let's read what he says in Jeremiah 20, verses 7 and 8. "O Lord, you have deceived me, and I was deceived. You have overcome me and prevailed. I have become a laughingstock all day long. Everyone mocks me. For each time I speak, I cry aloud. I proclaim violence and destruction, because for me the word of the Lord has resulted in reproach and derision all day long." Jeremiah was faithful to the word, even though he paid a price for speaking the truth of God. Great application point there. You speak the truth of God in this sick world, you're going to pay the price. A lot of it is just ridicule, which is a tough thing to bear, especially if you come from an honor society like China or like the southern portions of America. It's real tough when people shame you and violate your honor. The last duel fought in Western civilization was right down the road from me, the cash duel. I used to pass the historical marker every day on my way to teach college. We don't like to be shamed. And it's tough when people make fun of you. It's tough in general, but especially for people like the Chinese and American Southerners who think that honor is very, very valuable. It's not more valuable than the word of God, though. Jeremiah in verse 15 says that God has made Jeremiah drunk with wormwood. The Oxford Languages Dictionary says that wormwood is a woody shrub with a bitter aromatic taste, used as an ingredient of vermouth and absinthe and in medicine. Vermouth is a kind of wine. Absinthe is a green, strong liquor that's made with wormwood. It's basically bitter. Verse 16, God has broken my teeth with gravel, Jeremiah says. When corn is ground with new millstones, grit from the millstones mixes with the corn. So then when you eat the ground up corn, your teeth hits the grit, the gravel, and it can break your teeth. I remember in China, we would eat rice all the time that had sand in it, and you just feel your teeth hitting that sand, and it's so unpleasant. God has made Jeremiah cower in the dust in verse 16. This is what Adam Clark says about that. To be thrown into a mass or bed of perfect dust, where the eyes are blinded by it, the ears stopped, and the mouth and lungs filled at the very first attempt to respire after having been thrown into it. What a horrible idea of suffocation and drowning. One can scarcely read this without feeling a suppression of breath or a stricture upon the lungs. Did ever man paint sorrow like this man? I love that 19th century English. We go down to Lamentations 3, verses 17 through 20, and Jeremiah continues his Jeremiad. My soul has been rejected from peace. I have forgotten happiness. So I say, my strength has perished, and so has my hope from the Lord. Remember my affliction and my wandering, the wormwood and bitterness. Surely my soul remembers and is bowed down within me. So Jeremiah in verse 17 has no more peace, he has no more happiness. In verse 18 he has no strength, it's perished, it's dead. And the last thing that he doesn't have is hope. His hope is perished. Now note this well, a prophet of God has lost faith and hope in God. It should therefore be no surprise that we might do the same also. When times are bad, the worst thing that you can do is lose hope. Always believe in God that he's never going to leave you. He's never going to forsake you. I don't care how bad things look. And even if you die, you're going to see him face to face. I mean, if Jeremiah had completely lost hope, he wouldn't be praying to God here. He says in verse 19, remember my affliction. Well, if he thought that God had completely abandoned him, Jeremiah wouldn't be saying to God, remember my affliction. Remember the wormwood. Remember the bitterness. Jeremiah is saying he remembers it in verse 20. My soul remembers. I want God to remember it too. Well, God, whether you remember it or not, I do. My soul is bowed down within me. Bowing down is a perfect symbol of submission to that which has you captive. Now that bitterness, translated in the NASB, is gall, which is a bitter substance. That word is translated in the Holman Christian Study Bible, Bible in Basic English, in God's Word as poison. Remember the poison that's within me. The King James, American Standard Version, Darby, New American Bible, and the Young's Literal Translation have it as gall. And I found a great definition of gall in some Bible dictionary somewhere. Unfortunately, I've lost the source, but let me read this to show you how bad this stuff is. The Hebrew means bitterness, the bile secreted in the liver. This word is also used of the poison of asp, snake poison. In Hosea, the Hebrew word is rendered hemlock. The original probably denotes some bitter poisonous plant, most probably the poppy, which grows up quickly and is therefore coupled with wormwood. Well, I don't know about that. The drink offered to our Lord was vinegar mingled with gall. That was to be an anesthetic, to dull Jesus' pain, and so therefore Jesus refused to drink it. Adam Clark says of this complaining of Jeremiah, and it's serious complaining. Adam Clark says this is not becoming to man when under the chastising hand of God, and while indulging this feeling, all hope fled. In other words, the more bitter you get, the less hope you have. And that's true. But we will see that Jeremiah's attitude is going to change. In verse 20, Jeremiah has a soul which is bowed down within him. Now, I said that indicated his abject state, but it could also indicate his humility. We go to verses 21 through 24, and we see Jeremiah's hope revived. This I recall to my mind, says Jeremiah, therefore I have hope. The Lord's loving kindnesses indeed never cease, for his compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore I have hope in him. Now in verse 21, Jeremiah recalls something to his mind. He says, this I recall to my mind. Well, what does this refer to? Well, usually it refers to which came before, but what came before was Jeremiah's infirmity and weakness, his bitterness. He's lost all hope. How could he recall that to his mind and then say at the end of verse 21, therefore I have hope? That makes no sense. So we need to take it as which follows. This, what I'm about to relate to you, I recall to my mind. And that's the reason I have hope. And what follows in verses 22 and 23 is a correct view of the divine character, as John Gill puts it, the Lord's remembrance of his people, what he had been used to do and would do again, and particularly what follows the abundant mercy of God and his great faithfulness. So we see that Jeremiah's hope had disappeared in verse 18 when he said, then I thought, my future is lost as well as my hope from the Lord. But now in verse 21, he says, I recall something about God, and therefore I have hope. So his hope has come back. And then in verse 22 and 23, we hear these verses that are preached so often and heard so often. Generally, I am opposed to jerking verses out of context, but these verses work in almost any application of suffering, or even when things are going good. The Lord's loving kindnesses never cease. Anybody who's followed the Lord, and I have now for over 60 years, it is really, really true. He'll never stop loving you. His compassions never fail. He will never stop having compassion for you. And that's why you have hope. His compassion's in you every morning, every day that goes by. God thinks of a new way to show his mercy and kindness to you. Great is your faithfulness. That sounds like a hymn that is sung often. Great is your faithfulness. It's a great hymn. How did God show loving kindness to Jeremiah? Well, he got him rescued from the cistern when he was about to die. And then Yahweh got Jeremiah rescued from the prison of the courtyard of the guard when Nebuchadnezzar told his underlings to let Jeremiah go. Don't you harm him. He's been preaching good things about us whipping up on Judah. And so Jeremiah's life was spared. He was not taken into captivity. So mixed with all the bitterness, there was a lot of compassion from God. Now, of course, Jeremiah could be talking about loving kindness toward Israel. As John Gill says, God left Israel a seed, a remnant from which the Messiah, the mercy promised, should come. Verse 24, the Lord is my portion, says my soul, says Jeremiah. Portion is inheritance. In other words, Jeremiah is going to inherit God. Of course, God as a testator is a very rough analogy because God never dies. But he's got an inheritance to give to his people. And Jeremiah says, I'm going to get you, everything about you, God. Therefore, I have hope in him. That's why Jeremiah has hope. Now, one thing about this, shall we say, negative confession of Jeremiah, just like Job, is it shows how miserable he was. And so it's great for us today to see how miserable somebody can be and still have hope. Because when people start losing hope, they start killing themselves. Lots of suicides. We go now to chapter 3, verses 25 through 28. The Lord is good to those who wait for him, to the person who seeks him. It is good that he waits silently for the salvation of the Lord. It is good for a man that he should bear the yoke in his youth. Let him sit alone and be silent, since he has laid it on him. Now the word good is repeated in verse 25, 26, 27. It's good, it's good. Those repetitions are for effect. Here's the good news that's coming. The Lord is good to those who wait for him, to the person who seeks him. Now, this is an important thing. God will show you all kinds of stuff, but he's not just going to dump it on you. You've got to seek him. He's good to those who wait. And wait just doesn't mean wait. It means wait with confident expectation. God usually does not answer prayers instantly. He's not a genie in a bottle to come helping you at your command. But if you seek him, he will answer. I remember seeking God for over two years, because I worried so much when I was in my early 20s. Vietnam War, parents getting divorced, you know, no money, the typical things. And I prayed every day, oh God, please make me stop worrying. And by golly, he did it. I was a skeptic, raised by an atheist rationalist. Miracles don't happen. And I read the Bible, I said, well, if miracles didn't happen back then, the Bible's a lie. And so I prayed that God would show me the truth. I prayed starting in high school. I prayed for 2 years. Actually, more than 2 years. When I was a sophomore at the University of South Carolina, God answered my prayer. It took 2 years of solid praying. Almost lost my faith. I read a book by C.S. Lewis called Miracles. Yep, Hume's wrong. Miracles can exist. And then I actually saw some miracles. Saw my leg grow out into thin air. And I don't care what Justin Peters or John MacArthur or any big shot cessationist says, they do not know what the Gehenna they are talking about when they say that miracles don't exist today. Yes, they do. And one particular miracle saved me from losing my faith. But it didn't happen without a lot of seeking and searching. 2 years of it. And if John MacArthur can't exegete my experience, I would respond by saying, well, then don't exegete the experience of people who get up in your church and talk about how God's changed their lives. No, that doesn't prove that God exists, but it's certainly a signpost that points that way, just like miracles do. Now in verse 26, Jeremiah says, it is good for the man who is waiting for the Lord to wait silently. In other words, without complaint, wait for the deliverance, for the salvation of the Lord. That's not talking about spiritual salvation. It's talking about temporal salvation. He's waiting in hope now. Romans 8:24 says, for in hope we have been saved, but hope that is seen is not hope. For who hopes for what he already sees? Hope is a special kind of faith. Faith is the essence of things not seen. Same for hope. You can't hope for something you see. You've got it. So hope is a special kind of faith. It's a confident expectation of the future, that something that you desire will happen in the future. That's not a wish. That's a hope. I know I've heard many, many Chinese people speak English, and they would constantly confuse wish and hope. Are you going to graduate this summer? I wish so. I wish. Wish means I want it to happen, but the probability is very low. Hope is I want it to happen, and it's going to happen. In verse 27, Jeremiah says, it is good for a man that he should bear the yoke in his youth. What kind of yoke? Fatherly chastisements from his father? Okay, but probably Jeremiah is referring to the commandments of the law. The next question to ask is, why does Jeremiah mention the yoke of his youthly education in the law? What's that got to do with waiting for God in the midst of troubles for salvation? Well, the connection is this. The disciplines of the past are necessary to deal with the disasters of the present. And that's why, parents of little kids, you need to train your children, because their life will not be easy. Nobody's life is easy. And you better train them in their youth and let them be yoked in with God's commandments. Otherwise, they will be doing things like putting smoke bombs in burger restaurants, like yours truly did and almost got arrested in my dumb and young years. Get yoked up when you're young. Verse 28, Jeremiah says, let the man who waits for the Lord sit alone and be silent. Since God has laid that yoke on him, God's taught him his commandments. Now just wait. Wait. And be silent. Quit griping. Quit complaining. And bear it. Endurance is a fruit of the Holy Spirit for New Testament Christians. So let's endure it. Don't murmur and complain to God about God's moral restrictions, about his yoke, because it was God who created those moral restrictions. John Gill says, he is that under the afflicting hand of God bears it patiently and does not run from place to place complaining of it, but sits still and considers the cause, end, and use of it. Good words. We go now to Lamentations 3, verses 29 through 32, and we will be finished with this first half of chapter 3. Let him put his mouth in the dust. Perhaps there is still hope. Let him offer his cheek to the one who would strike him. The one he's talking about is the one who waits patiently for the Lord. Let him offer his cheek to the one who would strike him. Let him be filled with shame. In other words, don't fight it. Suffer. Endure it. Verse 31, for the Lord will not reject us forever. Even if he causes suffering, he will show compassion according to his abundant, faithful love. In other words, just hold your horses. Don't blame God. Just endure it and wait till he shows that compassion that he's going to show. Verse 29, Job says, let him put his mouth in the dust, the one who waits. That means he needs to bow down in humility. As John Gill says, sensible of his own vileness and nothingness, his unworthiness and the unprofitableness of all his duties, ascribing the whole of his salvation to the free grace of God. You know, I could pick a bone with that. A born-again Christian is vile and nothing before God? No, he's the child of God. But he's a humble child of God, waiting to get his portion, his inheritance. If Gill had said, sensible of the vileness of this man's flesh, his nothingness outside of Christ, his unworthiness outside of Christ, I've got no problem with that. But when you hear this kind of, I'll call it Calvinist Presbyterian type rhetoric, you hear it too much. That leaves the door open for these hyperphrased heretics who go around saying, oh, so you think your God is a bad God, a mean God, and you're just a nothing piece of excrement. No, you're a God, as Kenneth Copeland liked to say. That's two extremes, folks. Both of them are anathema to me. In verse 30, Jeremiah suggests that this man humbly waiting on the Lord in silence should offer his cheek to the one who would strike him. In other words, don't fight it. Go ahead and take the shame. To be hit on the cheek was always considered a very great affront. Jeremiah has given us advice. Don't hit back. Wait for the Lord's compassion in verse 32. Jesus famously did that with regard to personal revenge. In Isaiah 50, verse 6, we see prophesied of Jesus, I gave my back to those who beat me, and my cheeks to those who tore out my beard. I did not hide my face from scorn and spitting. Jesus waited for the resurrection from the dead. He could have whacked those Pharisees in a minute, or those Sadducees. He could have killed them. He was the Son of God. But he didn't, because he knew God had better plans. If he would just endure for 3 days, horrible thing that he had to endure. I couldn't have done it. You couldn't have done it. But he did it. And he waited for God to deliver him, which of course is a great example. Even as Paul was an imitator of Christ, we could be imitators of Christ, to wait in the midst of affliction, to endure in the midst of affliction, and wait for God to show his compassion and mercy and deliver you, because his compassions never fail. His compassions are new every morning. In verse 31, Jeremiah says, for the Lord will not reject us forever. He might reject us temporarily for punishment, but he will not reject his children forever. Now that, of course, is referring to the elect, not the reprobate. They will be rejected forever in hell. Verse 32, even if he, Yahweh, causes suffering, and that's because of punishment. Verse 32 says, even if he, Yahweh, causes suffering, and that will be because of punishment, he will show compassion according to his abundant faithful love. I would love to hear Joel Osteen or Kenneth Copeland preach a sermon on verse 32, even if God causes suffering. Ooh, that's a negative confession. But no, God will punish his children, but even so, he will show compassion. And think about this. Don't you cause suffering to your children when you punish them? My parents caused me suffering when I was punished, but they loved me, and I turned out to be the fine, upstanding citizen I did, at least after I put that smoke bomb in the Burger Chef. And the reason I did was because I feared discipline. Well, ladies and gentlemen, Jeremiah has ended this first half of chapter 3 on a note of triumph and hope. And so we'll stop right there. And so we are ready in our next audio to go to Lamentations chapter 3, verses 33 through 66, which we will call Great is Your Faithfulness, Part B. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.